Hi, I'm Melissa Idris, and here with me I have Dr. Joseph Henrich, anthropologist and professor of human evolutionary biology from Harvard University. He's also the author of the book, The Secret of Our Success. Now, his research uses evolutionary theory to understand how human psychology gives rise to culture and how this has essentially shaped our genetic evolution. So he's here at Kazana Megatrends 2019, he gave a special address on evolving the collective brain. Thank you so much, Joe, for being on the show.
It's great to be with you.
Right, so I want to talk about the collective brain because, if I may paraphrase your work, essentially I think it's the collective know-how of how we've learned as a society, all the values and the culture and the motivations that we have learned from one another. So I want to get you to start, if you may, by explaining more about how humans are cultural learners and how this feeds into the collective brain.
Okay. So the key idea is that unlike other species, humans have evolved to be particularly good cultural learners. That from a very young age, we begin acquiring ideas, beliefs, values, motivations, our language from other people. And that when you have multiple individuals interacting over time and over many generations, this can give rise to fancy technologies and more sophisticated languages and institutions. And that when you compare different societies, one of the ways you can understand differences in innovation or the complexity of tools is by understanding how interconnected they are. Mm-hmm. And I mean, one simple idea is that if you have more minds, you're more likely to have somebody invent something, and then if that can be learned by others, it diffuses around. The next generation, somebody else invents something and it diffuses around. And that process is really accelerated by having dense social networks where people can learn from each other.
Okay, so interconnectedness, how we learn from one another. You talked about ideas diffusing, right? And the size of the population matters because how many brains there are will help you evolve faster. So these two elements are essentially the reasons why some cultures are more resilient than others, how some societies grow faster than others.
Yeah, but I've also made the case that this is crucial going back deep into human evolutionary history. So one of the ways I start off is with the lost European explorer cases. Okay. And these are cases in which some group of European explorers, or in one case American explorers, get lost, and they have to survive as hunter-gatherers. So they're lost in an environment like Australia or the Arctic, where hunter-gatherers have existed for centuries and doing just fine. But what you see is that the explorers, despite being frontiersmen or outdoorsmen, can't survive. They can't do the basic things to survive as hunter-gatherers. And this illustrates that we've really evolved to rely, despite our big brains, to rely on this vast body of knowledge and know-how about how to get around, how to make our ways.
Okay, all right. So talk to me about the size of populations, because I'm just wondering, is it just that we have, you know, lots of people, and that means a society can grow faster because you've got lots of minds? What happens if you have, say, smaller countries or smaller populations with, you know, maybe above average minds, as opposed to countries or populations that have bigger but average intelligence, perhaps?
Sure. Well, so a key thing is the size of the collective brain doesn't have to be limited to just the country, for example.
Okay.
So one of the things that Professor Nunn just showed us in a lecture he did is that if you have a lot of immigrants, you create connections back to the home countries of the immigrants, and they come and they innovate, and those around them are more innovative.
Oh.
So if you look at the U.S., counties that received lots of immigrants had more patents over the course of U.S. history, and they made the native-born Americans even more innovative than they were in counties that received fewer immigrants. And this is consistent with the idea that you're stretching the collective brain beyond your national boundaries, and immigration is one way to do that.
So immigration benefits the collective brain of the host country or the origin country?
It actually does both.
Oh.
So the connections are built. Immigrants maintain their connections back to the home country, and that opens the door to the flow of information between the two.
All right, so talk to me a little bit about the interconnectedness, as you mentioned a bit earlier, about how knowledge diffuses itself. What builds that interconnectedness?
Well, the key thing is trust and social relationships. And there's a natural inclination for people to build tight social networks among those they know and their families, those who share their language, their religious beliefs, and ethnicity. Mm. So the challenge to expanding the brain in the modern world is figuring out ways to build trust with strangers and for people to have flexible relationships where they can go to new places and make new friends, because it's that kind of mobile, flexible network that seems to make the collective brain even larger and stronger.
Okay. Where does diversity play in this? I mean, you talked about building trust, about having this kind of connectedness. Does diversity matter?
Yes, it's really crucial, because if you imagine if you have two people who know exactly the same stuff, if they come together, there's not much chance for a new idea, recombination.
Okay.
So when we look at inventions, most inventions and new ideas are recombinations or versions of different ideas coming together.
Mm-hmm.
So you want people with very different areas of knowledge and expertise to create kind of new inventions.
Okay, and how does the collective brain grow throughout the years? Because knowledge has to be passed not just between people, but through generations, right? So how do you have that kind of institutional memory for the collective brain?
Yeah, so you mean humans have been developing and culturally evolving ways to increase the fidelity of transmission across generations. So it's certainly the case that, you know, all human societies create a perpetuation of knowledge, but something like just teaching, so parenting practices can increase the fidelity. Institutions like schools can increase the fidelity of different kinds of knowledge. Song, story cycles, all these things provide ways traditionally for societies to
increase knowledge. So how is it that there are bits of culture, bits of the collective brain that are forgotten, that are lost, that that disappear? There are cultures that no longer exist in today's day and age.
Yeah, so one of the things about the collective brain is if you shrink it or people become less social or they become isolated, say ethnic groups spread apart and don't communicate, then you can actually shrink the size of the collective brain and begin to lose knowledge and know-how. And this can result for lots of reasons. My favorite example from my book is the case of Tasmania, where Tasmania was connected to mainland Australia until about 10,000 years ago. And then the climate changed, the seas rose, and Tasmania became an island.
Mm.
And they began losing technologies that they had over the next 10,000 years. Meanwhile, in mainland Australia, the technologies were getting fancier and better adapted to the environment. But it's also happened historically. So with the fall of the Roman Empire, you get the breakdown of Roman roads and Roman security, and then Europeans are actually living amongst structures, for example, that they themselves can't build. And so the Romans could make cement, Europeans couldn't make cement until the British reinvented it centuries later.
That is amazing. So history teaches us that the collective brain can actually shrink.
Yeah,
we can lose this knowledge and perhaps never even regain it back, right? Okay, well, we're going to continue this conversation in just a couple of minutes. Stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm Melissa Idris, and with me today is Dr. Joseph Henrich from Harvard University. We're talking about the collective brain, and just before the break, you talked about how the brain can shrink, right? I want to get your thoughts on where you think technology can play. Does technology have a role in growing the collective brain and also in, you know, I guess avoiding it from shrinking?
Sure. So technology is crucial because different kinds of technologies allow us to have interaction with people who are further and further apart. So one of the studies I've done in a book that's forthcoming is looking at how in Europe during the early modern period and into the Industrial Revolution, European cities were becoming more interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
So they were growing, but transportation costs were declining. So the people could travel more readily between cities and trade knowledge and information and easier to send letters and all that kind of thing.
Okay.
And then as you get new transportation technologies, the same kind of movement continues, and eventually you get phones and telecommunications and that kind of thing.
But what about the internet, say? I mean, the internet, Google, for instance, it doesn't means that we don't have to remember things, right?
Right.
All the smart technology that we have at the moment does that mean that we're using less of the collective brain, that we're remembering less, we're passing less information between each other?
Well, I think the internet really, it interconnects us more, and it allows us to trade more information. Now, of course, people do increasingly rely on their phones and other technologies to store information, but you can just think about that as our own brains getting extended, and then using our brain power for other kinds of things. So we've long been relying on cultural technology. So, you know, writing, the printing press, the development of writing. And back into history, even the earliest accounting records seem to be ways of kind of externalizing memory.
Right, okay, so you're just putting it down at least so that you can remember, and this is all part of the whole institutional memory.
Yeah, and so
having a record.
And so, if think of these as part of culture, the idea that culture's been shaping our biology has probably been going on for hundreds of thousands of years.
How has culture been shaping our biology?
Well, so my favorite example is the evolution of fire and cooking. So as best we know, fire has developed over 1 million years ago. And then we begin cooking our food, and this is a kind of external digestion. So what we see in human fossils after this is that our stomachs shrink, our teeth get smaller, our big jaws that were used for grinding food get smaller. And because now we can cook and cut things, so we sort of process food externally.
So how does the collective brain affect our biological evolution?
Yeah, so by creating technologies and tools, it means we can do things that we've previously needed a genetic adaptation for. So for example, just our muscles are weaker and our bones are thinner, less dense than chimpanzees. Mm. So a chimpanzee of the same size is 5 times stronger than say, a 150-pound man and a 150-pound chimp. And that's because we have projectile weapons, we have cutting tools, and so our system invests more energy in our brains to do cultural learning, to acquire and store all this information, and puts less into our physical abilities.
And how many years of evolution are we talking about?
Well, so in my book, I make the case that it probably goes back about 2 million years that we had some amount of cultural capacities. So we first began to develop fancier tools, knowledge about where to find underground tubers, knowledge about where to find water, things like that, and then eventually fire. And that this has been shaping our physiology and also probably driving the expansion of our brains. So the more information is cultural, the better you have to be to be able to look out into the world and watch others and learn that information. And so the name of the game becomes being a good cultural learner. Also communication systems. So we learn language, so the tools of communication, by watching others and learning from them. And then you're going to get a growing repertoire of words and grammatical tools, and then as a learner you've got to acquire those.
Do you think that we're putting enough emphasis on the importance of being good cultural learners in today's day and age?
Well, I think that what's often underappreciated in policy debates is the importance of sociality. So that so much of what we need to do is to make people more social, more cooperative, and more trusting in strangers. So when you're allocating, say, policies to create better integration, say, between ethnic groups, you're actually making a policy that's pro-innovation. Because the more those groups interact, the more likely new ideas, whether it's a new recipe or some new type of technology, can come out of that interaction.
I guess this is particularly interesting against the current backdrop of rising xenophobia. And I want to kind of get you to set the scene for us. Why is it important that we understand how we are all cultural learners, how the collective brain grows and shrinks against this backdrop, Joe?
Yeah, so the case that I make in my book is that we have a kind of tribal psychology. So left to our own devices, we tend to build these strong links with family and with those who share our ethnic markers, so our styles of dress and greetings and all the things that we acquire that tell us that people have the same norms. And that tends to make us into smaller groups. And so the challenge is always to figure out ways to expand that group, to make policies of integration, say, putting children of different backgrounds in the same school so that they get to know each other. Right. And then that kind of opens the door.
Okay, all right. Well, talk to me a little bit about how we can ensure that everyone has access to the collective brain. Because, you know, the reality is that in Malaysia, there is unequal access to the collective brain, to the Malaysian collective brain, through education, through social networks, through opportunities. How do we ensure that we have this kind of equal access to the collective brain?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know of enough specifically about the Malaysian case to make any specific statements. But in general, you want to be able to provide opportunities to people who wouldn't normally have opportunities mm-hmm. to get education. So just referring back to Professor Nunn's recent talk, he looked at the data from the U.S. Mm-hmm. And if your parents come from one of the upper, at the upper end of the income spectrum, you're just much more likely to be an inventor and have a patent. If you're a woman, you're just, even though if you have the same math scores as a male, you're just much less likely to be an inventor. So there's a bunch of things which seem to be suggesting that not everyone has equal access to being an invention, even controlling for their kind of, you know, whatever their test scores are, say.
Okay, all right. We're going to come back and continue this conversation right here. So make sure you stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm Melissa Idris. With me, anthropologist Dr. Jo Henrich, discussing the collective brain. Let's come back to what we were just discussing about in terms of how to make sure that we give equal access to the collective brain, making sure everyone benefits from the cultural learning. So do you want to elaborate a little bit on what
Well, one of the things we know from studying cultural learning in children is that we have inclinations or biases to copy certain kinds of individuals. And two obvious ones that there's been a fair amount of work on are a tendency to copy those who match you on gender. Mm-hmm. So boys tend to copy boys, girls tend to copy girls. And people also tend to copy those who share their language, their dialect, and other ethnic cues. Mm-hmm. So that means if you want to inspire other members of a certain ethnic group or a certain gender to become inventors or become entrepreneurs, that you need to create role models that match the learners on these traits. Okay. So active policy interventions that make it more likely for someone, a woman, say, to become an inventor means that you're going to create more female inventors in the future because people tend to look to those who match them on these characteristics.
Okay, so that's
a kind of thing I can do in life. Oh, that's one of the things women do. They're inventors.
So representation matters, of course.
Yes.
But this works both ways, doesn't it? So you kind of, because cultural learning is such, you learn the good and the bad. So when you have a good role model, you kind of model yourself after that. Does it also work the other way? You know.
Sure. If you're raised in a disadvantaged environment and the most successful folks around you are drug dealers or criminals or something, mm-hmm. that seems like a sensible avenue to a young learner who's acquiring their notions of, like, what are the kinds of things a person like me can be?
Okay, so on that note then, how do we build social norms that are more, you know, pro-social, pro-innovation, more inclusive?
Well, I mean, any kinds of norms that would promote these kind of role models, gender equality, interaction among ethnic groups, things like that are mm-hmm. going to be the kinds
okay.
of things.
So what are you
I'm not really a policy person.
Well, so. That's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, if you were advising policymakers about the collective brain, I think that's a lot of the conversation at the Khazanah Megatrends Forum has to do with that, this awareness of how you know, the collective brain can be used to grow the country economically, you know, through invention and technology, and also just social norms to make us think about where we're coming from and where we're heading. Mm-hmm. So what would you you know, advise policymakers to keep in mind when creating policy in perhaps a more inclusive Malaysia and a more inclusive world?
Well, a couple things. The first is to remember that people are really cultural learners and that they're using these cues to figure out who to learn from. So I mentioned the cues of gender and ethnicity, but another one is prestige. So if you want to get people to do stuff, if you can persuade the most prestigious members of the society to express those values or especially even demonstrate those values, then that can have a big effect.
Prestige.
So a classic thing that all philanthropists know, or that organizations that want to get philanthropy know, is that you get someone high status to make a big donation at the beginning of some banquet or something, and you're much more likely to get subsequent donations.
Oh, that works.
Yes, apparently that works.
Because we emulate.
If you know, this very, if Beyonce is willing to make that donation, then I want to make that donation too.
Okay, all right, Joe. I want to talk to you a little bit about your next book, because I find it fascinating. And you've got the new book coming out soon, The Weirdest People in the World, How Westerners Became Psychologically Peculiar and Particularly Prosperous. So tell us about that.
Why yeah, so this began in 2010 when I was working with two cultural psychologists. And we began to gather all the data from psychology and other related fields like behavioral economics and to compare populations. And we found a great deal of diversity in people's individualism, willingness to trust strangers, analytic thinking, so thinking about categories instead of thinking more holistically around the world and in all these different domains. Mm. So what I've been working on for the last decade is trying to explain that variation. And in particular, European and European descent populations tend to be highly individualistic, particularly oriented toward trust and cooperation with strangers, but less concerned about family and kind of their local communities, and more inclined to this analytic thinking, more concerned about intentions, actually, too. And so this took me into trying to explain it, and I ended up reading a lot of European history and trying to develop some ideas around that.
And what did you find?
Well, the core of my idea is that one particular brand of Christianity, the one that evolved into the Roman Catholic Church, instituted a marriage and family program, which rather than having intensive kin groups where people marry their cousins and marry polygynously and own land corporately, it broke them down into individual monogamous nuclear families. And then people were unable to kind of reconstitute these large extended families, so they began to develop voluntary associations. So things like guilds and universities, and there were these charter towns in Europe where you could voluntarily enter the town and become a citizen of the town. And there was kind of a selection process. And so this created a different way of organizing social life, which then affected people's psychology. So one of the core ideas in the book is that our psychology responds to the institutions we're embedded in. So in a world where you're embedded in clans and tight families and lots of social obligations to your extended family, you tend to think about the world differently. You tend to think in terms of relationships and this kind of small local group, that's where your loyalty is.
Right.
As opposed to a group where you're trying to find other people to build relationships with, and it could be strangers and whatnot.
So did that change throughout the years, I mean throughout the generations? Because you talked about, you know, having small interconnected groups, but In generations to come, perhaps, you know, opening up of society means that you're looking at strangers more and building connections there.
Right. And so the idea is that if you're able to create this world where you can just go out and find strangers and make friends, go into business ventures, marry, all those kinds of things, you're creating a very different kind of world. And I make the case that this started in Europe, and then, you know, now it's globalization is very much that process.
Right. Okay. So are you planning to look at Asia, perhaps? You know, understanding how Asians are particularly psychologically peculiar and particularly
prosperous? In some of my... So, you know, it's a global study, so I'm trying to explain global psychological variation.
Right.
And so in several of the chapters, I, you know, look at cross-country variation. Mm-hmm. In one of my studies, I compare different provinces in China. So China varies in the intensity of its kinship, not based on the church the way Europe did, but there is some variation due to whether you did rice paddies or you did wheat farming. And so the ecology affects the intensity of these families. And so in the more rice-growing parts of China, there's more of this holistic psychology, more of clans and kind of intensive kinship.
What does the type of grain have to do with? What is the ecology?
Well, so for rice paddies, you need these large kin groups like clans in order to organize production. If you have wheat, a single person with oxen or different kinds of plow animals can plow it, and you can be more independent as a single nuclear household.
Amazing. All right, so I feel like we've covered the collective brain, and I'm going to give you the last a minute or so to kind of just give a message to Malaysians who are watching and how we should be thinking about growing our collective brain, because it's not just coming from the top. It's not just policymakers and politicians who have a say in the collective brain. It's all of us that make it up. So
sure.
If you could sum up your opening address at the Kazanah Megatrends Forum for us.
Well, the sort of shortest way to say it is it's better to be social than smart. And what that means is that if you increase the amount of social interconnections you have, you make your society much smarter as a group than if you increase its intelligence by an equal amount. In fact, in simple models, you can show that the effects of more social relationships have a much bigger effect on how innovative your society is than increasing everyone's IQ by an equal amount, an equal percentage.
So my takeaway would be to make sure that I am interconnected with my...
Yeah, build trust. Build and trust. It's also true if, as you as an individual, if you want to be innovative, you've got to connect with diverse people with different backgrounds than you and different ideas and different expertise. And that's the way you can be a more innovative individual.
But Joe, would you agree with me that we are in an age of a crisis of trust?
Yeah, so that's the big problem.
That's the big challenge.
So there's a lot of decline in trust. And so the key is to figure out how to increase trust.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me. It's been such a pleasure.
Great to be with you.
All right. I'm Melissa Idris, and I will be back with you on another episode on Astro Awani. So I'll catch you then. We'll be right back.